MacCast, Saturday, September 14th, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac. I just messed up my own intro. The show for Mac. I never do that. The show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? I'm going to leave that in there because I think that's kind of funny. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you here with me for another episode. And what an episode it is going to be, because we are just coming off of announcement week. Apple had its September iPhone event. As expected, Apple announced the iPhone 5C and 5S. The rumors turned out to be true. Most of the stuff we already knew about. I don't know how you feel about that. I have mixed feelings. I talk to a lot of people who say it really bothers them that we sort of know everything leading up to the event. But for me, it's still exciting times. I find it very surprising. And there were a few surprises in this keynote, a couple things that Apple was able to keep secret. Specifically, they had a whole new chip in the iPhone 5S, that M7 coprocessor. We're going to talk about that a little bit. So we'll be talking about all of the announcements, probably more of my just sort of reactions to them, my thoughts on the things that Apple announced. I'm sure many of you by now probably know a lot of the details. We'll cover the highlights, so in case you missed it, you don't miss anything. Some of you maybe already even have your iPhone 5C orders in, because pre-orders for the iPhone 5C started on Friday the 13th. Supplies still seem to be good, and we'll talk about that too. So if you didn't get your order in, I don't think you need to worry too much at this point. But we've got that to get into, and of course some great feedback and questions from you as well. But before we do that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and I'm very glad to have back as a sponsor Crash Plan. I said it, I think, the last time we had them on the show. They're probably the perfect sponsor for me, because if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, you know how fanatical I am about backup, and you probably also know that I've been a CrashPlan customer for a really long time. And here's the deal. You know, I know you're backing up because you listen to the MacCast. You probably have Time Machine. Maybe you've got a clone backup. You're doing archives, something like that. But a lot of people leave out or leave to the last thing that they set up some sort of offsite backup. So what are you going to do if you have a catastrophe, something happens, fire, flood, your hard drive gets stolen, all those sorts of things? What are you going to do if that sort of situation happens? And that's when you need something like CrashPlan. We've got all have this valuable data on our Macs. We've got cherished family photos, your entire iTunes collection, all those purchases, ebooks, business and personal documents. You don't want that stuff to go missing for anything. And CrashPlan makes it so easy to back that stuff offsite. It's a continuous, minute-to-minute, secure offsite backup solution. And it doesn't do anything that you're going to notice in the background. I've had it running on my Macs for years, and they really use very minimal CPU usage, and you can even adjust it. You can adjust the CPU usage, you can adjust the bandwidth, you can customize it, you can have it running in the middle of the night if that's the only time you want it doing its thing. And it is super easy to set up. You just go, you sign up for a plan, you download their software, and within literally a few clicks, you're backing up. It's just set it and forget it. Plus, it starts backing up the most recent files. A common complaint you'll hear people say about offsite backup over the internet is that it's too slow, it takes too long. Well, it's going to look at and it's going to analyze and it's going to start backing up your newest files first. So the most recent stuff you've been working on is going to get up there, it's going to be safe, and you just let it run over time. You're really not going to notice it, and eventually you'll have everything backed up. So don't even think about it. They use sophisticated byte pattern analysis after that and data deduplication to detect file changes and things like that. So once you have everything backed up, from that point forward, it's just going to back up the things that are changing. And so it's going to be much quicker, lower on bandwidth, and you have versions and all that good stuff. Plus, they have a mobile application for iOS, Android, and Windows Mobile. So you know what that means? If you need to get a document on the go and it's been backed up by CrashPlan, you have access to it. It's really cool. I use this feature all the time. If I've forgotten a document that I need access to, I know I can get it out of my CrashPlan backups when and where I need it. And they have yearly unlimited personal plans. They have family plans, which is why I have them, very affordable family plans. And if you need to get your files up there quicker, you can even use their service. You can send in a hard drive and have them sort of preload everything. You can do the same thing for recovery. So if you need to get critical files back in a hurry, you can get back up and running. So don't wait any longer. Protect all of your valuable data. Just go to CrashPlan.com to get all the details and to sign up. You will be so glad you did it. And a big thank you to CrashPlan for their support of the MacCast. So let's talk about some of the things that Apple announced this past week. One, they did a rehash of iOS 7. A lot of the same stuff that they covered at WWDC. We've known a lot of the details about the different features and functionality of iOS 7. Biggest thing being the whole new user interface. But what we didn't know is what date can we actually download it and start running it on our iOS devices. It's actually going to come out on September 18th. So that's just a couple days before the official release date of the 5C and the 5S. It's going to be available for iPhone 4 and later, iPad 2 and later. And that's actually something recent. Until recent builds, it was iPad 3 and later. So iPad 2s will be able to run iOS 7, also 5th generation iPod Touches. And the one new thing they had during the keynote that I picked up on was they did say that they have some new ringtones and alert sounds. I hadn't heard about those before. They're still going to have the classic ones, although they're now under a new submenu. And I think Phil Schiller said during the presentation that the older sounds have actually also been remastered. I tried to take a listen to see if I could hear the difference. I really couldn't tell, but they supposedly will sound better, even all those old classic ringtones and things that you like. Something that didn't make it, and Apple didn't talk about this, but immediately developers who were downloading the GM builds noticed that the iCloud keychain feature was not in there. It's been removed. Since it does sync with OS X Mavericks, it's assumed that maybe they pulled it out to wait until OS X Mavericks actually releases, probably sometime in October. So that would make sense. That'll give them a little more time to finish it up. Plus, you're going to want your keychain stuff to sync to your desktop as well as your iOS devices. So that happened. Something else somewhat related to iOS 7 going on is that the Apple TV is also expected to get a software update on the 18th as well. Apple didn't talk anything about Apple TV at this September event, but it's being rumored that some key new features are going to be the ability for you to play your iTunes purchase content on another person's Apple TV over AirPlay. And if you're saying to yourself, well, I could do that already, what's new about that? Apparently what's happened is the software has been tweaked on the Apple TV to allow you to stream content that is in the cloud, purchase content on your account, your iTunes account, that is not loaded on your iOS device. So currently, if you have that content loaded on your iOS device, you can play it on any AirPlay device. In this case, you'll be able to actually just send a signal to the Apple TV and it'll stream your purchased content on someone else's Apple TV directly from Apple's servers. So that's the little difference. People are saying that's, I guess, a little bit more like how the Chromecast works. There's also been these inklings that maybe there's going to be a hardware refresh. There were some images of Apple's quote-unquote set-top boxes sitting in crates somewhere. So some people are thinking there might be some new hardware and that that might be announced at an event in October. Here's the thing about new hardware. I can't think of anything in the Apple TV that Apple could add hardware-wise that's really going to make a huge difference. Maybe upgraded processors, maybe a little bit more RAM for doing buffering of 1080p content, maybe smoothing things out a little bit, but I don't expect any kind of major refresh to the Apple TV set-top box, at least not this year. So it'll be interesting to see if Apple does do a little revision bump. If they did, I think it'd just happen quietly. I don't know that they'd make any kind of new big announcement about it, but that's just my opinion. iOS 7 also has some significant new features for enterprise customers, and this wasn't talked about at the event, but it was reported on a couple blogs that I saw, and I think this is important. If you're working in IT, you can now configure and customize the open width choices that show up in the sharing menu. So if you have certain applications that your work groups and the people you're deploying iOS devices use, you can tweak those settings, maybe shut out certain apps that you don't want made available in the open with menu. Another really cool feature is per application VPN. So that means when certain applications are launched, they can be set up to use the VPN network, or maybe even more importantly, that you can lock out certain applications from the VPN. So employee personal applications and data doesn't have to go through your VPN network. You can actually force it off the VPN network. They also mentioned that it's going to have enterprise single sign-on, and there's a whole new mobile device management, a set of mobile device management protocols that you can access. So iOS 7 doing more for the enterprise, and that's going to be a big deal as Apple pushes more and more to try and get corporations and people to use iOS devices. And we're going to talk about the fingerprint scanner too, that's in the new iPhone 5S. That's going to be really important in certain enterprise situations where security is a big deal. And maybe if Apple can enable some sort of two-factor authentication with the fingerprint scanner, that could help them in government and high security kinds of situations for different corporations as well. So that was pretty much iOS. Again, we're going to be able to have it next week. Moving on, the iPhone 5C was announced officially. It is, as expected, exactly the same specifications pretty much as your iPhone 5 that you have today, but with color polycarbonate plastic casing. Now, something about the plastic shell, some details that have come out since, it's going to be shatter resistant, heat resistant. It's going to have all those properties of a polycarbonate plastic, but as Apple pointed out in the keynote, it is going to be still having a solid, rigid feel in your hand. They put in an interior metal frame that's also doubling as the antenna system, and that is laser welded. Everybody who's gotten their hands on these things so far say they feel really nice in your hand. The case is also lacquer coated, which should help avoid any kind of scratching that's typically associated with plastic cases. If you remember, and I certainly remember on my iPhone 3GS, the back of that thing would get pretty scratched up. Apparently, and from some of the early leaked tests we saw, the iPhone 5C should be a little bit more durable. So you're going to have a harder time scratching it. It still could scratch, but everybody's saying they're going to be, you know, pretty robust. And they're likely also easier and cheaper for Apple to manufacture because it was reported that the metal unibody systems, they require these really high-end, very expensive machines. And I think this sort of proved itself in terms of the availability numbers we were seeing on the iPhone 5C. We didn't have the stockouts or sellouts, and that may be due in part to the manufacturing process now being more streamlined. These are the same components that Apple's already had on order for the iPhone 5 for the most part. And with the plastic cases, I think they can manufacture those more on demand and probably quicker. So you're not going to have the sort of runouts of stock. Apple can kind of keep up with supply and demand. It's either that or the iPhone 5C is just not selling as much on launch day, which could be a thing as well. A lot of people have been talking about the fact that the iPhone 5C is more for the average consumer, probably not the early adopter. They're probably going to see sales ramp up as we move into the holidays and more people find out about it beyond just the tech community and the people who follow Apple. Although Apple's gotten the word out pretty well, and I think a lot of people are still excited about it. I expect Apple to sell a ton of iPhone 5Cs. Whether they do it right away, it'll be interesting to see what the pre-release and launch day numbers look like versus, say, like the iPhone 5S. But that information will be coming, and of course, we'll be reporting on that in future episodes. As far as the colors go, it did come in five colors: white, blue, yellow, green, and pink. Some people had been calling the pink color red, but Apple officially has called it pink. And they're doing a cool thing. They're going to ship with color matched wallpapers. So it's color all the way around. You're going to get that full color experience right out of the box. Apple also announced that they're offering silicone cases in six different colors: white, blue, yellow, green, pink, and black. I've talked about this on some other shows that I was a guest on. I was actually on Cult of Mac's Cultcast this week. If you didn't catch that, you might want to check out my initial reactions to the announcements there. I also was on Mac OS X Day 6 this week, and we talked a little bit. But one thing I was shocked by when I saw the product images for the iPhone 5C with the cases on Apple's website is that if you've seen the cases, they have all these little holes down along the bottom. So if you've got the Apple logo on the back on the top, and then there's all these little holes. And anybody who's familiar with iPhones knows that down at the bottom of your iPhone, you have the iPhone branding on the back. So you have the word iPhone and then all of the FCC legal information and stuff like that. Well, with the cases on, the little holes cover up the entire word of iPhone except for part of the letter H, the O, and the N in iPhone. And so when you're looking at the back image, it says non on the back of it, like non-phone. And to me, it doesn't look nice. It just doesn't look finished. It looks a little odd. And just having that word non. So I've been calling the iPhone 5C the non-phone because of Apple sort of missing that little detail. And I don't know how Jonathan Ive sort of let that through or if they just don't care. I also noticed that in the images on Apple's website, they don't have the other FCC and legal information showing there. So they at least photoshopped that out or had sort of pre-production cases that didn't have that information screen printed on it yet. So I think it'll look even more cluttered and worse when you have all of that data sort of showing through. So it's going to be interesting to see what these things look like with the cases on in person. It is a 4-inch Retina display, integrated touch panel, full sRGB standard in terms of the color, and it's a widescreen 1136 by 640, again at the Retina 326 ppi resolution. So same specifications, as I said earlier, as the iPhone 5, powered by an A6 chip. One little update that they did do, there's actually two little updates in the iPhone 5C. It has a slightly larger battery. We're going to talk more on exactly what that gets you in a minute, because there's also a larger battery in the iPhone 5S. But the FaceTime camera has also been updated. It looks like it's going to have better low light performance, bigger pixels, probably a little bit bigger sensor. They've also, I think, added backside illumination, so that should help with the color quality. And it will work with FaceTime audio. So 1.2 megapixels, 1280 by 960 on the FaceTime HD camera, recording at 720p resolution. It also has the same EyeSight camera as in the iPhone 5, 8 megapixel backside illumination, the IR filter, as well as a 2.4 aperture LED flash, the 5-element lens, all the stuff that we're used to. It is going to be slightly bigger and a little bit heavier than the iPhone 5. It's 4.9 inches by 2.33 inches and 0.35 inches thick. It's about 1.37 millimeters thicker than the iPhone 5. But it was noted that some of the iPhone 5 and 5S cases actually might fit a 5C. It's just slightly bigger, but not enough to throw off some of the cases. So if you are upgrading to an iPhone 5C, you might be able to use your old iPhone case. In terms of weight, it is about 0.7 ounces heavier at 4.65 ounces. And it's going to come in a 16 gigabyte configuration for US $99 or a 32 gigabyte configuration for $199. Those are on a 2-year contract. If you want to buy it off contract, unlocked, $549 for the 16 gigabyte and $649 for the 32 gigabyte. And as I mentioned, it is shipping on September 20th. And pre-orders have already started, so they're available now, and they will be at Apple stores and also the carriers as well as retailers on the 20th. So it went on sale Friday at midnight, hasn't sold out. The yellow unlocked version, for some reason, without a SIM, did sell out. It's now showing a ship date, at least in the US, of September 25th. So if you were planning on getting an unlocked yellow one, you're going to have to wait just a little bit longer. But again, not too bad. just a couple days longer on the shipping. The one big sort of fallout that came out of the iPhone 5C announcement was many saying that for China, the price just isn't low enough. Leading up to this, a lot of analysts, a lot of the media, myself included, fully expected the price to be more in the $400 range unlocked. So we're looking at almost $150 more than really what I was expecting it to be at. And I think a lot of people were expecting it to be at to really compete and really make a dent in the emerging markets like China and India. iPhone 5C 16 gigabyte unlocked in China is going to be about 4,488 won, or that's roughly about $800 US, so certainly not cheap. Apple did announce at the event that they are going to continue to sell the iPhone 4S. I guess I should have commented on that. Apple has replaced the iPhone 5 with the 5C. You have the 5S on the high end, and then rather than like they've done in the past, moving the 5 down to the low end, which was something I thought they might do but wasn't really certain on, I kind of thought more they would do exactly what they did, which was sell the 4S as the free phone, carrier-subsidized free phone, or the low-cost iPhone. And they announced they're going to have an 8-gigabyte model of the 4S available free at many carriers. In China, that one is going to be available for around 3,288 won, or roughly $540 US. So still on the pricey end for the Chinese market. Many people have noted that the iPhone 4, the 8-gigabyte iPhone 4, is still available in China from Apple, and that's coming in at 2,588 won, or approximately $420 US. And from everything we were hearing about leading up to this event, that $400 price point in China, $400 US, was sort of the sweet spot to hit the low-end market or kind of compete with some of the lower-cost Android devices in the region. That's still pretty high for China, when considering you've got devices in the $130 range that are running Android that have some pretty nice specs. That's really hitting that low tier market. But we've also known that's typically a place that Apple doesn't really want to, or a piece of the market that Apple doesn't really want to play around in. So another big factor going into this is a lot of us were expecting that Apple would announce a deal with China's largest carrier, China Mobile. Now, both the 5S and the 5C apparently have been approved by China's Ministry of Industry and Information Technology for use in China. It's going to be on the other carriers, so that helps with that. But it also means that the iPhone could be on China Mobile. Apple just needs to get a deal done with them. And China Mobile has over 700 million subscribers. That's actually more than double the entire population of the US. So there would be a huge vested interest for Apple to get the iPhone on China Mobile. And it's still expected they're going to get a deal done. They've been working on this for years and years and years, but this may be finally the year, or maybe early next year, that we'll see Apple do it. And I was just thinking, you know, as much as everybody's complaining about the price being too high, even if Apple only sells the iPhone 5C and 5S to the middle class, upper middle class markets of China and sort of the high-end customers, I would have to imagine that's still potentially hundreds of millions of potential customers. And I've also read that China's middle class has this really high demand, high percentage demand for luxury products, specifically in categories like clothing and jewelry. But I would imagine that also extends to high-end consumer electronics products like the iPhone. And I have to wonder if the gold iPhone 5S isn't meant to appeal to that kind of consumer, the sort of luxury conscious consumer who wants really high-end classy products. So I think Apple still can make some pretty big inroads in China with these two devices. One, if they get on China Mobile, and two, if they really market and sell to that sort of middle upper class market. Everybody's sort of focusing on the lower end of the Chinese market, but Apple obviously isn't planning on competing in that space. So what we ended up with was a low cost iPhone, a lower cost iPhone, but not a low cost iPhone. And so really at this point, the only change was that second tier level is now a new device rather than last year's model. But I still think that's significant. I talked about this on some of my earlier episodes. You know, you and I know it's last year's model just with a new skin on it. But in terms of marketing, when a customer is going into an Apple store and they don't want to pay the high-end premium price, and Apple can turn around and say to them, or an AT&T representative, a Verizon representative can turn around and say to them, well, we have this brand new iPhone. It starts at $99. That is really a sweet price point. And then throw on top of that, they're just fun and colorful. And I think a lot of people are discounting the fact that there's a huge contention of consumers that means a lot. They like being able to personalize and customize their devices, have their favorite color. And I think that the tech media and those of us who are sort of pundits, we miss that point. Consumers like that sort of choice. And I think Apple is really going to hit a home run on this one, as long as it doesn't leak out that what we know, these are just last year's phones with the new skin. And consumers are watching Apple, I think, more closely than they have in the past. So it'll be interesting to see if Apple can actually pull this off. But they're definitely saying we're not playing in the low-cost market, and that they feel, as they always have, that less market share and possibly lower unit sales are okay, because they can do that and make more profit. They're going to be making a lot of profit off the iPhone 5C. And if they sell a lot of them, I think those quarterly results coming up in the next quarter, those numbers are going to be really impressive and really huge. I think it also says that Apple is firmly backing the subsidy model and saying that they are hoping carriers extend this outside the U.S. It's not been quite as popular outside the U.S., but in some of these other markets, without subsidies, Apple's not going to sell a lot of phones. And maybe they're okay with that. Maybe they're trying to push more carriers to move to a subsidized model. I'm not really sure on that front. I'm just sort of speculating and throwing out some wild hairs. I don't know if they can. I don't know if they can change consumer behavior or the corporate behavior of some of the carriers outside the U.S., but maybe they're hoping to do that. Or maybe, and I think this is more likely, frankly, they're just not that worried about that low-end market. They're happy to let Android duke it out and compete in that space for low margins, and they'll just take the higher margins and sell to higher tier, more luxury sort of conscious consumers. And I think different people are going to have different opinions about that. Me personally, I've always kind of understood that this is how Apple runs their business. They've never really get cared too much about market share. They do seem to care a lot about profit share and also the quality of the kinds of products that they can build. And they use higher-end components. It costs them a little bit more, and they charge a little bit more. And I think they recognize the value of their brand, and they don't want to dilute that. And I guess that's something that I can respect. I know some people think that they should just throw into that low-end market and just crush the competition by shrinking their margins, but I just don't think that Apple is that kind of company. And I think with what they did with this announcement and not lowering the prices of their phones, I think they firmly said that's not what they're going to do. And it's hard to remember that leading up to this, it was the media and Wall Street who kept rallying and saying that Apple was going to do a low-cost device. Apple never said it was going to do that. We just all assumed it was going to happen. And when it didn't, the market reacted very negatively and everybody reacted negatively. But I don't think Apple was surprised, and I don't think they were caught off guard. And I think they knew exactly what they were doing. Wow, I talked a lot more about the iPhone 5C stuff than I thought I would. Let's move on to the biggie, the iPhone 5S. This is where the most changes happen in terms of the iPhone lineup. The iPhone 5 and the 5S actually have exactly the same size and weight, 4.87 inches by 2.31 inches and just 0.3 inches thick. Weighing in at 3.95 ounces, excuse me. As far as pricing goes, same pricing as the iPhone 5, 16 gigabytes for $199, 32 gigabytes for $299 US, and 64 gigabytes for $399. That's all subsidized with a 2-year contract. off contract, they're going to run you $649 for 16 gigs, $749 for 32 gigs, and $849 for 64 gigs. And Apple will launch the iPhone 5S in the US, Australia, Canada, China, France, Germany, Japan, Singapore, and the UK to start with. They're going to be quickly rolling out into other countries. But this is the first time Apple has actually launched a phone in China from the very beginning. So we're going to get to see how the Chinese market is going to react to the higher price point phones. I'll be very curious and watching very closely the numbers coming out of China. And of course, we'll talk about those on future episodes of the MacCast. But one big thing that really disappoints me is that Apple is not doing pre-orders on the iPhone 5S. If you want to get one on launch day, you're going to have to be in line at a retail store, at an Apple store, at an Apple authorized reseller. So that's going to be your carriers, Apple stores themselves, or, you know, some sort of partner, Best Buy, I think Walmart. You're going to have to check around and be watching your feeds to figure out where Apple's going to have them on sale. You will be able to order them online starting at 12:01 a.m. Pacific time on September 20th, but then you're going to have to wait for shipping, so you won't be able to get them on the 20th. They will be in Apple retail stores starting at 8 a.m. on the 20th. They're going to open up a little bit early, and you'll be able to get your iPhone 5s. It is going to be available in three colors, the silver and white. They do have the new gold model. Apple is calling it gold, not champagne, but it is that lighter champagne gold color. Actually looks really elegant, and most people that I'm talking to, I'm surprised. A lot of folks in the tech media and people seem to be very excited about the gold. I know a lot of people are going to be going for the gold and getting the gold model. I like the new black model. They're replacing the black with what they're calling space gray. And I just found out from Ken Ray, and actually a listener, that space gray, I guess, is also a color of that BMW makes available in at least some of their car models. So there's speculation that maybe Apple is color matching to space gray on BMWs. I don't think that's the case. I think the case, you know, the thing we heard was that the black anodizing is actually really hard to do. It's hard to get on there. And we know that the black phones took a lot of flack over scratches, especially on that chamfered edge. And it looks like with the new space gray version that they're going with just the polished silver edge like they have on the white iPhone. So I think it's going to look really nice. That's the color I'm going for. I think it harkens back to the original iPhone with the sort of gray and black playing off of each other. I think when the iPhone 5 came out, I mentioned that I was a little bit worried about the black being not close enough, but too close to the black glass portions on the back. And I never kind of liked how it was just a slight contrast between the two materials. So sort of really emphasizing that more, I think, makes it look really elegant. So you have three different color choices that you'll be able to order from. But as far as availability, one of the theories being thrown out, and I immediately thought this as well, because we had heard leading up to the iPhone 5S announcements that supplies might be constrained specifically because of the fingerprint sensor. We're continuing to hear those rumors that Apple is having a really hard time with yields on the Touch ID sensors. And so the assumption is that at launch, supplies could be really constrained, and maybe that's why Apple's not doing pre-orders. I think this could come back to really backfire on Apple, because I think, you know, on a launch day, on an iPhone launch day, the retail stores are already completely swamped. I think it's going to be 3 to 4 to 5 times fold the chaos at the retail stores now, and Apple has brought this on themselves, and it's going to be really interesting to see how they handle this. But I think you're going to have a lot of very upset, angry customers who can't get iPhones on launch day sitting around Apple retail stores. I know I am going to be there probably at least the night before, if not a full day before. I'm going to be keeping a close eye on the lines forming at my Apple retail stores. And I also thought, you know, we heard 2 days before Apple even announced that they were going to have iPhones that some folks were lining up at the store in New York. I guess they're looking like possibly smarter than they were before, now that we know you have to be at a retail store to get one of these things. But let's talk about some of the under the hood improvements, because there were three major things that Apple did with the iPhone 5S that I am super excited about. You probably are as well. First and foremost is the camera. I can't believe how much they did with the camera system, not just the camera itself in terms of the hardware, but more importantly, that combination of hardware and software that only Apple can do, and only they can do so well because they control all of it. So you have a five-element lens in there. They did reduce the aperture down to 2.2. They also threw in, rather than playing the megapixel race, they threw in a larger sensor, still at 8 megapixels, but bigger pixels, and that means more light, better low light response, better quality. You're going to get better quality images out of the new sensor in the iPhone 5S. It also came to be that they did the dual LED flash. We didn't really know the details of why they were doing a dual LED flash. That was announced as well. They're doing something they're calling a true tone flash. That's the marketing term for this thing. They're basically using two different LED colors, a warm color and a cool color. And then in software, they're doing an analysis of the lighting conditions that you're using the flash in. And then they're going to adjust the tone, those two LED flashes, colors in over 1,000 different variations to compensate for the lighting conditions to give you better color quality, improved skin tones when you're taking those flash photos. And they showed some samples and it looks really nice. It's still, I commented on this, it still looks like a flash photo, and I'm not a huge fan of flash photos. I typically shoot with my iPhone with the flash off. But it does look like you're going to get a lot better color quality. So it's not just going to blow things out. It's not going to throw your colors off as much. You'll still have a flash photo, but it will look a lot nicer. And then they've added enhancements to the camera system in iOS so that it'll do things like automatically set the white balance and exposure levels, create a dynamic tonal map now, which is a new feature. So I'm assuming they're also leveraging some of the image processing technology that's in the phone to help make this happen in a really fast manner. And they're also able to do digital SLR like autofocus matrix metering, meaning they're going to take multiple focal points and use that data and information to give you sharper, better photos. They've also added auto image stabilization. So if you're like me and you're a little bit shaky when you're taking your photos, you should end up with clear, sharper photos. They're actually also mentioned that they're taking multiple shots. So when you press that shutter button, I think they're taking up to three or are taking three separate images, and then they said the image processing can actually merge and sort of combine together the best parts of those three exposures to give you the best image. Something a little bit different than HDR from what it sounds like. We're used to them having the HDR image, but they're doing some more stuff to give you better quality photos. And as expected, they're also giving us 120 frames per second slow motion video. And apparently you can move dynamically in and out of the 120 frame per second mode. So you can go from standard 30 frames a second to 120 and then back out again. Along with that feature, they're also giving us a burst camera mode. So you can hold down the shutter button and have it take up to 10 8 megapixel images per second. So that's going to be great for sports and action stuff. And supposedly on the iPhone 5S, it'll actually go through, analyze, and present you what it thinks are the best photos in a sequence. You'll still be able to drill in and get at all of the images, but it's going to try and filter that so you're not cluttering up your entire camera roll with just tons and tons of photos if you're shooting in that burst mode. So some really cool features in here. And as I said, it's this sort of combination of hardware and software. Oh, you're also going to be able to auto adjust the exposure when you're shooting panoramas. So if you're starting in an area of shadow and moving to light or vice versa, it's going to be able to compensate for those variations in lighting and give you a more even panorama in terms of the color quality. So just huge jump forward in terms of the camera on the iPhone 5S, and a lot of people are excited about that. That is probably the feature I am most excited about. Anything that's going to let me take better photos that I don't have to think about. And I really think this is going to help Apple sell a lot of phones. I commented on a few shows that, you know, when you have that mom who's sitting at the soccer game and she's shooting pictures of her kids, and the person next to her has their Android phone and they're shooting pictures, and maybe they have the 41 megapixel, the Nokia thing. I know that's a Windows phone, but, you know, maybe they have more megapixels, but they're tinier and they're crammed on that little tiny sensor. They're going to look over and see the photos coming off that iPhone 5S, and they're going to say, how are you getting such great photos? And the response is going to be, I don't know, I just have an iPhone and I take pictures and this is how they come out. That's how you want your cell phone camera to be. And that means the next person that other mom is in looking at an upgraded phone at the carrier, they're likely going to consider getting an iPhone. And I think that's going to help Apple sell a lot of phones, that kind of technology where it's you don't think about it, you just take pictures and they look awesome. That sells devices at the end of the day, I think, especially to consumers, those who aren't caught up in all of the tech specs and stuff like that, like we are. Now, speaking of tech specs, though, another huge surprise. This did not get leaked out. Apple announced the A7 processor. We knew it was going to have an A7 processor. What we didn't know was that it's going to be a 64-bit processor. The iPhone 5S is the world's first smartphone with a 64-bit processor. And I was taken aback by this. Apple said that, and I thought, how could that be? They can't have the first 64-bit phone, but it turns out to be true. And when you think about it, it makes sense because, again, Apple has control over the hardware and software. And so for 64-bit to really work, especially on something like a smartphone, well, or on anything, rather, if you remember the transition to 64-bit on the desktop, we needed to have our apps updated and we needed to have the OS updated. Well, Apple announced that iOS 7 has already been rewritten for 64-bit on iOS, and that Apple's bundled applications have also been rewritten for 64-bit. So you can still run your 32-bit applications just fine on the iPhone 5S on the new A7, but new 64-bit applications are going to be fully optimized for the platform. And the Xcode tools that developers use have also been updated so that they can compile 64-bit applications. They can even do universal applications that'll run on both 64-bit and 32-bit. So it sounds like the transition is going to be very similar to the one that we went through on the desktop. And a lot of people are trying to come back and say, well, 64-bit on mobile doesn't matter because it's all just about how much memory it can address. And until you have more than 4 gigabytes of RAM on a smartphone, it doesn't really matter. Currently, with Apple's iPhone 5, we have 1 gigabyte of memory. Some are expecting the iPhone 5S. Apple doesn't give out these specs, but some of us are expecting it to have 2 gigabytes. I'm thinking we'll find out it has 2 gigabytes of RAM in there. But again, that doesn't matter when it comes to 64-bit. But where 64-bit does matter in the processor is how it can chunk through data, and specifically really large numbers. When it needs to crunch a lot of data with 64-bit registers, it means that it can pull in larger chunks of data and work on those in a cycle. So double a 32-bit processor. So 64-bit registers as opposed to 32-bit registers. And that is going to really make a difference on computational heavy tasks. Think things like games, video and image processing, 3D, all of that stuff is going to benefit from being able to chunk through that data in larger bits. So it will take 64-bit apps coming on the scene. They may take up a little bit more storage. A lot of people are wondering, am I going to need more? You know, am I going to need to get the 32-gigabyte iPhone or the 64-gigabyte iPhone because 64-bit apps are going to take up more storage? Likely not too much more storage. Most people aren't probably going to notice. 64-bit apps also might take up a little bit more memory to run. But again, I think that Apple probably has accounted for that and probably has doubled the amount of RAM it's going to have available in the iPhone 5S. The new processor is also going to support the newer OpenGL ES 3.0 graphics. As far as what we're going to notice in terms of performance day to day, Apple's telling us it's going to run about twice as fast or up to twice as fast as the iPhone 5 and the CPU, also twice as fast in the GPU. We saw some really impressive demos at the event. They had the folks from Chair and Epic Games, the people who make Infinity Blade, come up and show Infinity Blade 3. And it had real-time images and 3D stuff going on in there that looked like cutscenes. I think they mentioned they had this dragon in there. And on the iPhone 5S, it can have four times the amount of texture detail that it does on the iPhone 5. And it didn't even break a sweat trying to present that stuff. So this thing is going to be a screamer in terms of a phone. I'm kind of super excited about it. Now, what's under the hood and how's all this technology working in the processor? Apple doesn't provide any of those details, but there's some theories being thrown around. I think Rene Ritchie over at iMore wrote a nice piece. I think it was him, or it might have been Peter Cohen. I can't remember, and I apologize for that, who wrote the piece. But basically, they're speculating that the processor's likely based on the newer ARM V8 architecture, possibly also has the PowerVR Rogue chip for the GPU, and as I already mentioned, that they're likely doubling the RAM. So that's how they're cramming all this performance and speed out of that A7. And almost immediately, competitors stepped up to say that they're going to be copying Apple. And they didn't say copying Apple, but said, hey, we're also going to have 64-bit coming soon. Samsung almost immediately announced it's going to have 64-bit devices coming. They didn't say when. A lot of speculation is that folks would be shocked if they can get it out before the end of 2014. So Apple likely has a pretty big lead on this. And it's not just getting a 64-bit chip in your phone. The hardware, as we already talked about, isn't the whole story. They're going to need a 64-bit version of Android, and Android apps are going to need to be converted. And I think that's going to be more difficult for the Android market to do. Not impossible, but their ecosystem, you have different players controlling the hardware versus the software versus the operating system, so they're all going to have to kind of come together. It'll be interesting to see if Apple doing a 64-bit processor on a smartphone first is the thing that pulls them together and gets them really working hard on pushing towards 64-bit, but Apple's certainly leading the charge on this one, and they made a big point of that during, as they should, I think, during the keynote. I mentioned earlier that the single A7 processor isn't the whole story. Apple also announced that the iPhone 5S has an M7, what they're calling motion coprocessor. And what this is going to do is this is a little processor specifically for all of the sensor data that's in the iPhone 5S. So things like the gyroscope, the accelerometer, the compass, and the other sensors, it's going to be continually monitoring that for user activity. And what this means is that to get that data and to process it, it's not going to have to wake up the CPU, and it can run on lower power, and it's going to feed that data to different applications like the Maps application. So it can know things like when you're walking versus when you're driving and present you more relative directions. Apple announced that Nike is going to be developing a fitness application using the technology so that you can track your movements and how many calories you're burning and all those sorts of things and compete against your friends to get better fitness. And I expect more apps like that to kind of leverage the technology that's in the M7. And after I saw everything Apple was doing with that chip, I immediately thought, and I think others have thought this as well, that the M7 is likely a byproduct of a lot of the stuff we've been hearing about the R&D that Apple's been doing in working on wearables. So I think this is their first foray into a wearable. We already know that our phones are basically wearables. We have them on us all the time. So Apple's throwing this chip in there. They're playing around with the software. They're going to see what they can do with it. And I think they've been developing this chip for possibly, you know, everybody's been saying an iWatch. I think it's not just going to be a watch. I think Apple's wearable, whatever they bring out, is going to be something totally new and totally revolutionary, something we're not expecting. And I think this is the first sort of inkling of the kinds of work that Apple's working on behind the scenes. So it's kind of cool to see the M7 in there. And I fully expect it to be further developed and make its way into some other future product that Apple's going to do in the wearable space. So that's the processor. Last major technology point to talk about, the thing that everybody was expecting, the fingerprint scanner on the iPhone. And it's a fingerprint scanner, but really so much more. It's, again, really a platform, something Apple's starting with on the iPhone 5S. It's somewhat limited, and that's one of the complaints being levied against it, but I think it's enough to get going. Apple's calling the technology Touch ID, and it works out of the box for unlocking your phone, as well as signing in with your Apple ID to make purchases from the iTunes Store, the App Store, and the iBook Store. And while other smartphones have reportedly had fingerprint scanners, this one is not just a simple fingerprint scanner. It differs in a number of significant ways. One, it can read your finger in any orientation. A lot of other kinds of scanners require you to sort of slide or swipe your finger over the sensor. This doesn't. It's just a simple touch in any orientation. And the reason is they're using a capacitive sensor versus an optical one. So it's not just taking a picture. What it's actually doing is reading the inner capacitive subdermal layers of your skin. And what that means is the inner layers, I guess, are capacitive. The outer layers are not. So it takes the difference between those two and uses that to form the image. And that means things like smudges or not defined ridges are probably going to be less of an issue for this sensor. And then that touch ring, there's a little ring around it that is a touch sensor. That starts the scanning, but there's some speculation that it also might serve a secondary purpose. And a lot of this information came out of an article by Rich Mogul over at TechHive. He did some digging and made some deductions about how Apple might be working this kind of technology. But basically, that ring could also add a small amount of current to help boost the capacitive signal and reduce some of the signal errors and noise that might occur. And so that's going to result in a more accurate sensing technology. And that was key, I think, when Apple was developing this. This has to work out of the box really, really well. Apple's technology is likely harder to fool than some other kinds of technologies because it can do things because of the capacitiveness. It can tell the difference between live and dead tissue. Apple also was quick to point out that it does not store fingerprint images. They did not go into details about how it was actually working, but again, Rich Mogul's piece speculates a little bit, and I think everything he says makes perfect sense. He said likely what's going on is they take the data from the sensor, basically the quote-unquote image, and then run it through an algorithm to kind of make a fingerprint template. And then they likely take that template and they hash it. They jumble it up and combine it with a bit of random data, something called salting for those people who know what that is. And then that is what's stored in there. And so when they need to read back and verify your identity, what they do is they run the new scan through exactly the same process and then compare the two. They compare what they've stored to the new scan, and if they match, they know you're authenticated. So the whole thing is a process very similar to what Apple does now with passcodes. The only difference here is that rather than starting with a code number or a code that you entered, they're starting with this fingerprint template as the sort of source image. So it makes perfect sense that that's how they would be doing it, and that would mean they're not actually storing an image. A lot of security people immediately were like, well, if the image is in there, what happens if someone steals the image? Then they have your fingerprint. They're probably not actually storing an actual fingerprint image, and Apple even says that they're not. So the fingerprint data is also only stored on the device. That was another area of concern. You know, where is this data stored and how can people get access to it? It's actually in an area on the A7 chip itself, something that Apple calls a secure enclave. It's not backed up outside of the device. It's never sent to Apple's servers or into iCloud. It's only accessible and made available to the Touch ID sensor. So that does mean if you restore your device, you will have to reset up your Touch ID. You're also going to be required to use a passcode to use Touch ID, so you have to have both those things in there. The passcode is going to serve as a backup in case of error, the sensor's not working. It also will secure access to changing the Touch ID data and other settings. Another thing that was pointed out is that the passcode will also be required if the phone is rebooted or if it has not been unlocked for 48 hours. So if you haven't unlocked it using the Touch ID for 48 hours, it's going to require you to punch in the passcode. And that 48-hour limit shouldn't impact the primary user, but I have to wonder if you have family members, other people who use your phone that you want to put on the Touch ID system, it could mean that they're going to have to use the passcode on occasion to get back into the system if they're not using, if you're not sharing that device every day. Now, one thing that's not going to be there out of the box with Touch ID that I was a little surprised about is apparently two-factor authentication, meaning requiring that you use not only the fingerprint scanner, but also the passcode every time to log into the device. That's much more secure than the fingerprint alone. The fingerprint scanner probably isn't any more secure than a passcode. It just is a lot more convenient. And I think two-factor ultimately, as I mentioned earlier, is going to be really important for higher security enterprise kinds of situations and can really help Apple make some inroads into that market. But the key with this first version, I think, for Apple was really that more customers are using some sort of system to lock their devices. And what they found, according to some of their studies, was that 50% of their consumers weren't using even a simple passcode lock because they just found it too convenient. And with the Touch ID, there really is no barrier to setting up a passcode lock because literally just touching the home button unlocks your phone. And early reports say it works incredibly well. I was actually shocked. It seemed almost too good to me because you just hit your finger on there and it unlocks. It looks like you're just pressing the home button like you have no lock code on there at all. But obviously it's scanning and letting you into the system that way. Apple did admit that while the sensor is really good, it's not 100% accurate. Things like moist fingers, so sweat or residue from creams or lotions can throw it off and cause it to not work as well. Also, reading any fingers that might have scarred skin can also be error prone, but that's why the system does allow you to store up to 5 different finger profiles. And those are really easy to set up. You just tap your finger to the home button multiple times. They got this really cool animation that sort of fills in a fingerprint in red. And once it's all filled in red, then you know you have a good scan. And Apple also did say that every time you use it, it uses that data to help improve the accuracy of the system. So it should work really, really well. And it's just going to get better and better. And this is just the start, I think, of fingerprint authentication, biometric authentication on our mobile devices. And again, this is something I fully expect Apple's competition to try and replicate really, really quickly. You know, Apple acquired a whole company to get this technology in there. So it's another area where I think Apple's competitors, in terms of the quality of the sensor, how well the system works, integration of hardware and software, it's going to be something that is going to be hard for Apple's competitors to catch up with. And I fully expect it to take up to a year, if not longer, to really see a system that matches what Apple has today. So I really think the iPhone 5S put Apple another step ahead in a lot of ways of the competition. So if you can't tell, I'm really excited about these new products, even if Wall Street and maybe some of the analysts aren't as excited as we are. But hey, we're just Apple fans, right? We love this kind of stuff. And it was great. It was a really, really good event. And I'm looking forward to the next event, expected to be an iPad event in October. Couple other things to just comment on, that some information that came out after the event. If you're planning on getting AppleCare Plus with your new iPhone, Apple has upped the accidental replacement costs on all new AppleCare Plus plans. So it used to be $49 per incident US. It's now going to be $79 per incident. So $30 more. The AppleCare plan itself is still $99 US to add to any phone. And if you've already have a device that has the AppleCare Plus on it, your accidental replacement cost is staying the same. It's not changing. So it'll still stay at $49. So the $79 price is just for new plans. And also, it was announced that AppleCare Plus is now going to be available in the UK, France, and Italy. In the UK, the fee to replace an accidentally damaged iPad under a 2-year warranty plan is £39, and replacing an iPhone is going to be £55, and that's the accidental replacement cost. Language on the UK AppleCare Plus page also notes that buyers have up to 6 years to get a free repair or replacement if the device does not conform to the contract of sale. So it sounds like you're covered for a little bit longer. I'm not sure exactly what they mean by conforms to the contract of sale, so there may be some little play in there. It was also announced that AppleCare Plus was brought to the iPod Touch and the iPod Classic as well. You can buy it for $59. I'm not sure what the replacement costs, the accidental replacement costs on those devices is. I didn't see that reported. And Another thing with the iPhone 5S and 5C, Apple has finally brought back their own docks. So Apple does have Lightning docks available for the 5S and 5C. They have Lightning connectors and audio out ports. You do need to bring your own Lightning cable. So it doesn't come in the box, and those are going to retail for $29 US. Personally, I think there's some nicer docking solutions out there, maybe a little bit more expensive than Apple's, but if you want the one from Apple, you can get one now with these new devices. A few other iPhone 5S and 5C things that we now know, now that the event has happened. Even though they've brought improved FaceTime HD cameras to the 5S and 5C, Apple seems to be no longer supporting FaceTime HD calls, even over Wi-Fi. This is according to the specs on Apple's website and a report by iLounge. They are saying the supported resolution is HVGA resolution, which is 480 by 368, so certainly not 720p that you can shoot with the FaceTime HD camera. And the reason for the change is being speculated on, but it seems logical, and that's that Apple recently lost that lawsuit to Vernetics. I think I mentioned that on a prior show. And that means they can no longer do peer-to-peer FaceTime calls. So what they were doing until recently is most FaceTime calls, they would connect to the call and it would go directly, the data would go directly from device to device. So I would assume that means less latency, it's more direct, they can probably push more data and bandwidth. Now they're having to route through central servers at Apple's data centers. And that is reportedly causing quality issues with the current system. So I'm guessing they're cranking down the resolution a little bit to save on some of the bandwidth and processing that they have to do so that they can keep the quality of the FaceTime calls up in terms of, you know, not going pixelated and not losing call quality. But unfortunately, you're not going to get the highest HD quality for your FaceTime calls. So no more FaceTime HD calling until, I guess, Apple sorts out some sort of new system. Hopefully that will improve in the future. I mentioned earlier improved battery life. According to FCC filings that a few sites have found, the iPhone 5C is going to have a 1,507 milliamp hour battery. The iPhone 5S, 1,570 milliamp hour battery. That is up from the iPhone 5 battery, which had 1,440 milliamp hours. And that translates to you and me to about 2 hours more talk time on 3G or LTE. So moving from 8 hours on the iPhone 5 up to 10 hours with the 5S and 5C, you're also going to get about 25 hours more standby time. Apple said the standby time on both the 5S and 5C should be around 250 hours. So more battery life, always a good thing. There's a 3X video zoom if you're using the video, and that looks really, really nice from what I hear from reports, that it's not pixelated at all on the video. I guess Apple's doing some sort of cropping mechanism using the quality of the video, the HD video that the iPhone can shoot, to give you a better video zoom. And I would also assume there's some stabilization going on with the new processor and chips and things like that also. There were some iPod updates. Actually, the iPods are getting the space gray color. The iPod Touch, the iPod Nano, and iPod Shuffle are all now available in the new color. The prices and sizes are staying all the same. And something that didn't happen that I think a lot of people are going to be excited about, and I thought would happen, Apple is still selling the iPod Classic. So if you are a fan of the iPod Classic, the additional storage, that's still available, probably because Apple also did not bump the iPhone 5S up to a 128 gigabyte storage option. That was actually one thing that did surprise me. I thought that we might see the whole line move up. So basically the bottom of the line be a 32 gigabyte, then have a 64 gigabyte, and then on the high end a 128 gigabyte. But Apple kept all of the storage sizes the same on all of those devices. And as we mentioned, they're going to be in store on September 20th. If you want to save a little bit of money, at least in the U.S., Walmart has announced that they will sell the iPhone 5C in store for about $20 less than you can get anyplace else. So it's going to be $79 for the 16 gigabyte model at Walmart. of the 5C and the iPhone 5S, the 16 gigabyte model starting at $10 cheaper, $189.99. Again, both those prices with a new 2-year contract, or if you're upgrading, you know, moving to another 2-year contract on your upgrade. And again, offer in-store only. They said it would be available and in-store on September 20th. So if you have a Walmart near you and you want to try there and save a little bit of money, you might do that. So that's some of the latest stuff we know about the 5S and 5C. Let's talk a little bit about some carrier details and data plan stuff. Apple does seem to be offering the iPhone 5S and 5C in 4 different LTE models. In the U.S. and Puerto Rico, they're going to have one model that supports AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile. This same phone is also going to support the carriers in Canada. In U.S., the Sprint model, though, is different for some reason. I guess that maybe the LTE bands are a little bit different. And so that supports the U.S., Puerto Rico, and also Japan. So the same model that Apple will sell in Japan is going to be the model that's supported in the U.S. on Sprint. The third model is a model for France, Germany, and the UK and all the carriers there. And then the fourth model seems to support Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Korea, and Singapore. Now, looking at the individual bands, I have to tell you, I have no idea how cellular bands work, because if you look at the individual bands, there does seem to be a lot of crossover between these 4 different models. And so I don't know if that translates into carrier hopping, you know, if you travel globally. I'm not sure which is the best model to get. I would assume in the U.S. you just get the AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile one, and that is going to have compatibility in a lot of different countries depending upon where you're traveling to. But Apple does have a page up on their website, apple.com/LTE, I think it is. I'll have a link in the show notes if you want to go through those details and sort of see which phone might be best for you in terms of your coverage, especially if you know you're going to be roaming around internationally. Unlimited data plans in the U.S. We haven't heard anything specific from Apple, but I received a question from George Starcher. Hey, I have my unlimited data plan with AT&T still. If I upgrade to an iPhone 5S, am I going to be able to keep that plan? So I did a little poking around, and I found a thread over on Mac Rumors where a couple people claim that they called AT&T, and one person in the thread also claimed to be a worker for AT&T, and they all say that you will be able to keep your unlimited data plans. The guy who worked for AT&T actually gave some details. He said that if you have an iPhone 5, your current plan, if you look at your billing, should say that you're on the data unlimited for iPhone 4G LTE, and it'll say somewhere either on the website, if you look at your billing, or on your bill, it'll say that. If you have an iPhone 4S, and I also assume older, they will have to move you to that data plan. So the iPhone 5 was the first one with 4G LTE. So you need to get moved to the 4G LTE unlimited data plan. And when you do that, they will prorate your bill. What's actually going on is it'll be exactly the same rate, $30 a month for the unlimited data plan. But because they're moving you from a non-LTE unlimited plan to an LTE unlimited plan, they have to change it over in their billing system. So you'll get credit for, you know, how far you are in your non-LTE plan, and then get charged. I guess it'll get translated over to your new LTE plan, but it's going to be the same rate. It just show up weird on your billing. And then AT&T's LTE unlimited data plans, you need to know, though, are data capped, meaning that you have unlimited data for the first 5 gigabytes on LTE, but after that, you're going to get throttled down to what's basically edge-like speeds. But that's something that Apple was already doing under the other unlimited data plans, and I think the limit might have even been lower. So you might ultimately be better off. But the point is that unlimited is not "quote unquote" unlimited, and so that's AT&T, you can keep your unlimited data plans. On Verizon, they do force you off of your unlimited data plan if you're moving to a new phone. And they've been doing that for a while now, so I don't think that's a surprise for anyone. Now, another bonus is that in the U.S., Straight Talk Wireless, they're the ones who offer pay-as-you-go data plans or cell phone plans for AT&T GSM compatible iPhones, they announced that they are now going to support LTE speeds for data. And so with them, you can get unlimited everything month to month, no contract for $45 a month. That's unlimited talk, text, and data. It is on the AT&T network, so you have to have an AT&T GSM LTE compatible phone, but it doesn't have to necessarily be unlocked. So you can buy an unlocked one, or you can use the phone that you already have, even if it's not unlocked, just as long as you have the AT&T version. And their network supports SMS, but not MMS, picture messaging. You can get it to work. It requires a little bit of technical fiddling, so that may or may not be a deal breaker for you. They also don't support visual voicemail. Now, I read some people claiming you could hack that in, but others saying that it just gives you the visual voicemail menu, but the actual visual voicemail features don't work on Straight Talk. And I did a whole episode about Straight Talk. I almost went and paid outright for my iPhone 5 and got Straight Talk as my carrier. But the one caveat with Straight Talk is that that $45 a month, that is per user. So if you have multiple users in a household, you need to do the math and figure out sometimes it might be more worth it to get you on one of those family share plans that AT&T offers. Straight Talk does not offer any kind of share plan. So you have to pay $45 for each phone you want to use with the Straight Talk network. And while Apple did not seal a carrier deal with China Mobile, they did land a huge deal with Japan's largest carrier, NTT Docomo. NTT Docomo has about 60 million customers in Japan. That's a little less than half of Japan's entire population. One report I was reading said that Docomo actually had lost about 66% of its customers because they didn't carry the iPhone. So I guess they've been trying to get it back for a while, and they're going to be using it along with a number of promotions to try and woo customers back to the network using the new iPhone 5S and 5C. There's already some predictions now that the 5S and 5C could make up to about 40% of all the new contracts on NTT Docomo. This is according to Nikkei. And SoftBank and KDI, who are the competitors in Japan, are already reportedly offering the iPhone 5S along with discounts that could effectively make the phone free on contract. And this is sort of to compete with Docomo. They're really worried NTT Docomo is going to steal their customers, and they're really working hard. So if you're in Japan, you may be able to get a good deal on SoftBank or KDDI, get a free iPhone 5S during your upgrade. You'll have to look into the details of the offer and all the things that it entails, but effectively a free iPhone 5S, which I'd love to be able to get that here in the US. And then Apple's website was showing for customers in the UK that LTE support is only available on EE and Vodafone. It was verified, I read a couple places, that both 3 and O2 have confirmed that their devices will support the iPhones on their LTE networks. So you don't need to worry about that. It'll also support 4G on those networks too. So if you're a 3 or an O2 customer in the UK and you want to get a new iPhone, you will have full LTE support. So that's some carrier stuff. And that's pretty much what I have this week for the iPhone 5S and 5C announcements. Wow, a lot, actually. Let's move on. Let's talk about OS X update. Apple did update OS X to version 10.8.5. It fixes a number of issues, including an issue that may have prevented mail from displaying messages. So if you weren't getting your mail messages, you definitely want to upgrade to 10.8.5. The update improves Apple file sharing protocol file transfer performance over 802.11ac Wi-Fi, resolves an issue that could have prevented the screensaver from starting automatically, improves XSAN reliability, improves reliability when transferring large files over the internet, improves performance when authenticating to an Open Directory server, addressed an issue that prevented smart cards from unlocking preference panes and system preference, contains improvements included in the MacBook Air mid-2013 software update 1.0. So if you missed out on that one, you'll be able to pick that up. And also had a number of security patches and updates. And if you have an older version of the operating system, Snow Leopard 10.6 or Lion 10.7, there also is a security update available for your operating system. So if you didn't pick up 10.8.5 or the Snow Leopard Lion updates, you can get those from by running software update on your machine or just heading over to apple.com/support. And with that, that is everything that I have for the news for this week. Let's move on to some of the feedback and follow-up from prior episodes. I want to start off with one more update to the iOS in the car advice that we got. I received a voicemail from Mike, and he was actually in the car as he recorded his audio, so it was a bit noisy, so I'm not going to play it for you, but he made a very good point that I wanted to bring up. And he has an Audi, and in his Audi, it has one of those, it's one of those situations where there's the cable going into the glove box, and so he's able to connect his iPhone into that, and it provides charging as well as access to his music content, his iTunes content. But he notes, you know, with that system, I can't get access, or he can't get access to any kind of third-party applications. So that means no things like Downcast for your podcasts. You can't really control or get access to Pandora. So that's just something to take into account. If you're looking at a new vehicle and you want iPhone integration, how deep does the integration go? You may be better off just using Bluetooth integration. A lot of cars have Bluetooth integration, A2DP for the stereo Bluetooth, and you can just have a dock there, put your iPhone in that, and then connect over Bluetooth, and then get access to all kinds of functionality directly through the iPhone. Things like Siri, being able to control your Downcast and Pandora music. I think I mentioned that, you know, I'm doing a similar thing. I have to use a physical cable. I just use the 1/8-inch line-in jack. But I have a stand there. It's right up there by my radio, so I can reach down. I can hit the Siri button and just use Siri to interact hands-free, you know, other than pressing the button, which I view as not much different than sort of changing the presets on your radio. But there is also iTunes in the car to look into. That's coming from manufacturers reportedly in 2014, gives you access to Siri's iFree, which means you'll have a button on your steering wheel you can use to activate Siri. You can get her to do things like play your music from iTunes, compose text messages, get maps and directions, read your notifications, get your schedule from your calendar, add reminders and all that sort of stuff. And the big deal with Siri's iFree is that when you activate it, it does not turn on your iPhone screen, so you're not going to be distracted by the screen there. But iTunes in the car kind of extends that to the next level and is going to integrate a lot of iTunes or iOS functionality into the navigation systems, into the displays that are built into certain vehicles. So again, you're going to be able to do things like send and receive messages, get access to Apple Maps and navigation, play iTunes music and even iTunes radio, and get directions and addresses from texts you receive and emails and feed that into the entire system. But once again, this is all built-in iOS first-party stuff. It's not third-party applications that you're going to get access to, at least not initially. Hopefully Apple, once it has iOS in the car, is going to give access to other apps. Things like Pandora, I think, would be really handy for a lot of folks, alternative podcast players, and what have you. But a good point made by Mike. So you're going to want to do your research, especially if you're in the market for a new vehicle and you want to find something that has the most iOS integration. And that's sort of what we've been talking about over the last few episodes. I also need to comment on something that I told you about on the last episode. Omni Group had done this really cool thing. So if you use any of the Omni applications, Omni Focus, Omni Outliner, Omni Plan, they have just a ton of really great applications. I'm a huge Omni Group fan. They came out with this really great deal because, you know, with Apple's Mac App Store, if you buy an application through there and then a developer wants to give you upgrade pricing, they can't do that on the App Store. So what Omni did is they wanted to have their customers who purchased through the Mac App Store be able to take advantage of upgrade pricing when they put out a new version. So they developed this thing called the Omni Keymaster that would go through your apps purchased from the Mac App Store, your Omni applications, verify them, and then issue you a product code, a key that you could use to then do a paid upgrade through the Omni website directly so that you could get discounted pricing. Well, The day after I told you about that on the MacCast, they had to pull that application off of their site. So they can't offer upgrade pricing. They didn't say exactly why, but I think we can all probably guess why. So that means if you want to buy an Omni application and you want to be able to, in the future, get upgrade pricing, you're probably going to want to buy it directly from them through their website. Just a little recommendation to you. And I was very sad to see that they had to pull that application, and the timing was regretful for the MacCast, at least. Another thing that we talked about was upgrading your iTunes purchased movies. I saw a really cool tip that mentioned if you've bought movies from iTunes in the past, and I bought some really early on before they even had 720p HD, now they have 1080p HD versions, that you can go through, you can, you know, I would back up your movies first, but back up your movies that you have stored locally, delete them from iTunes, and then go into the iTunes store, go to your purchases, and then re-download them, and you can pull them down in whatever quality you have set up in your iTunes preferences to pull down, either 720p or 1080p. Well, David pointed out a good reminder, and something that I didn't really stress in that episode, is that you don't need to download higher quality versions than what you can use. Meaning, if you have a television set that only does 720p, you probably only want to pull down new 720p versions of those movies and not 1080p versions, because that way you can save some hard drive space. The 720p versions are going to be slightly smaller, or significantly smaller, than the 1080p versions. Now, I say that, you know, if you're not worried about only being able to back up then the 720p versions. If you want to have higher quality 1080p versions for backup purposes, maybe for future proofing, you're planning at some point to get a 1080p television set and you don't want to have to re-download those files, then by all means do that. But if you want to save a little bit of hard drive space and you don't have a 1080p set, it might behoove you to just pull down the 720p quality version and not the higher quality versions. And so I thought that was a good point and a good tip from David. Bill emailed me this week, and he had a question about wireless drives and how they work and how maybe they differ from network-attached storage drives and devices like the Transporter. You've probably heard Transporter Connected Data is a sponsor of the MacCast, and they make something called the Transporter that is a peer-to-peer cloud storage device. And so he wanted to know, what exactly does that mean and how does that compare to these things that I've seen on the market that people are calling wireless storage drives. And there's a bunch of these kinds of hard drives, these wireless hard drives, or sometimes they're flash drives on the market these days that are from companies like Seagate and Kingston, SanDisk, Western Digital. There's a bunch of companies that make these kinds of products. And I've talked about one of them on the show as well. I have a Maxell AirStash, and I also recently just got to test out a HyperDrive iUSB port mini. And both those devices are little kind of flash devices or devices where you can plug in a USB hard drive and then turn that into this sort of wireless storage device. And they use all different kinds of media, different kinds of form factors, but they all provide basically the same kinds of functionality. So some might have traditional hard drives, like some of the products from Seagate or Western Digital. Some might use flash or SSD drives, and some even can connect to existing USB drives that you have, or thumb drives or SD cards, and turn them into wireless storage devices. But the way they all work, typically, is that they have Wi-Fi built into them and, in essence, set up a little Wi-Fi hotspot. So they act as a little ad hoc network that then you can connect to. You usually have a specific IP address that you have to plug in and configure, or you just select the device from your airport menu. You connect to it. You can often set up encryption, so you can do WPA and secure it, lock it down. But then once you've connected to it, then you can browse it because they have a little server built into it. Little server software basically setting up as an autonomous file server. And you typically connect to it directly, but in some instances, you can also hook it up to your network, and then it becomes a little bit more like a NAS drive. But more often than not, what you're doing is you're connecting directly to the drive itself. And then once you're connected, you can access it a couple different ways. Very often from a web browser, so they'll have a little web server in there, and it'll have a web application, and then you can browse through the files on the storage device. You can add files and get files off of it through a web interface. You can also very often connect directly from your Mac. So sometimes it'll show up in the Finder using Bonjour. It'll just show up as like a network volume. And you can also connect to it, say, over WebDAV or maybe even FTP. You might go under the Finder's Go menu and use the Connect to Server option, type in the IP address, and then connect via WebDAV. On your iOS devices, you can very often use an application that will allow you to connect to it either via WebDAV or FTP or directly from an application provided by the company that makes the product. And so examples of this would be Pages allows you to connect to a WebDAV server. A lot of these wireless storage devices offer a WebDAV server, so you could put Pages documents on there and access it directly from the Pages application. Or you could use an application like GoodReader that allows you to connect to servers. There's also specific file browsing applications you can get for your iOS devices. I like one called Documents by Readle. It basically creates a Finder-like experience on iOS and allows you to access things like Dropbox and cloud storage servers, but also allows you to access these Wi-Fi storage devices. And it can be really great for browsing through applications and opening them up on different applications. And many of the devices, as I mentioned, also have their own dedicated apps. As a matter of fact, some of them require that you use their dedicated applications to be able to access the data that's on these drives. And another thing is that many of the Wi-Fi drives are designed also to act as little media servers, allowing you to throw onto them movies and music and photos that then you can access directly from your mobile devices or from your PC, Mac. And you can often stream the media directly to their applications or to your web browser or whoever it might be directly off of the drive itself. So this is great if you travel a lot. You can get one of these, you know, very often, like the AirStash in this new USB port from HyperDrive, iUSB port mini. They look like almost oversized USB thumb drives, and you can attach storage to them, usually in the form of like an SD card, and you can store movies and media content on there and then stream directly off of this little Wi-Fi storage device. You know, it's a little server basically in your pocket that you can pull content off of. And that's pretty much how they work. So how these differ from traditional like network attached storage devices, they're similar in some ways, but in a NAS, I typically think of that as something that you're going to connect to your home network. It might be wired, it might be over wireless. Very often it's going to be a multi-disk system. Most of these Wi-Fi drives are just a single disk, very often very portable, a 2.5-inch disk, or they'll have flash storage on them. NAS drives tend to be a bigger box with more hard drives, a lot more storage. It has some of the same features, like it's going to provide you a file server or a media server, but it often even goes beyond that. You know, you can do things like set up print servers, and you can do Xbox media servers on them, and you can install applications and sort of take them to a whole nother level. A lot of these Wi-Fi drives tend to be a little bit more simple than that. And very often NAS drives can also act as almost like cloud servers, providing remote access to your files as well. Whereas the Wi-Fi drives, I think some of them have that kind of functionality, but typically they're going to be the kind of thing that you just take with you. They're already mobile, so you just bring them along with you. And then moving back to the transporter, how is that different? The transporter is a network storage device. It's a single 2.5-inch hard drive in a little tiny enclosure. You hook it up to your Ethernet, you plug it into power, and you run the software, and then that software sets up a folder in your Mac And it works a lot like Dropbox, meaning that anything you place in that folder is automatically synced over to your transporter on your network. So it kind of works like a network drive, but it's not necessarily like a file server. It does have something called the transporter library that allows you to use it like a NAS drive, where you have files stored on the transporter and they stay on the transporter. They don't sync over to your Mac, and you can access them remotely. So you do have that option. And you can also share your transporter's connected folders. They call the folders that you set up inside the transporter connected folders, because you can invite people to share those folders with you. And when you do that, that data can be synced to their computer, also to their transporter. So if they have a transporter and you have a transporter, you can go directly transporter to transporter. And the big deal here, the big difference with transporter versus other cloud-based solutions like Dropbox, is that there's no central server. It's peer-to-peer. That's where the private part comes in. This is all private cloud sharing or peer-to-peer sharing. You go from transporter to transporter, or you go from transporter to Mac or PC. There's no intermediate server that your files are going through. So it is direct and private and secure. And that's the big deal in the transporter and the difference. And that's sort of how it differs from some of these Wi-Fi devices. So hopefully I've explained that. I know this stuff can get a little bit complex. Bill, if you have further questions, feel free to email me, or if I kind of missed something or got something wrong, feel free to back me up. And I'd be curious to know what kinds of products and devices you guys are using. For iOS, I really like my Maxell AirStash. It's just this little thing. I plug a 16 GB SD card into it, and it allows me to store files and data and information on this little thing that I can keep in my pocket and I can connect to directly with my iOS devices. So it saves a little bit of storage on the device itself. And if I need more storage, I just get a new SD card, and that's pretty cool. The HyperMac thing that I'm playing around with, its big deal is that it has a USB port on it, and you can connect a hard drive into it. And actually, USB powered hard drives are supposed to work as well. I haven't gotten that far into testing it, just got it on Friday. So I'll play around with that a little bit more and give you an update on a future episode of the MacCast. And then I have one more item for you today. Bruce sent me this email. He was having a funny little issue that would sometimes crop up when he was re-encoding videos that he had shot on his iOS device. What he noticed was that sometimes when he would run his videos through a tool like Handbrake to re-encode them, the resulted re-encoded videos would come out upside down, and he couldn't figure out, why am I getting upside down video? It goes in right side up and comes out upside down. And what was happening is that if you shoot your video on your iPhone, you know that iOS devices, we can have them in any orientation. So it shouldn't really matter how you're holding it. You can use it in that configuration. Well, if you shoot your video with the camera on the bottom, so if you're in landscape mode and the camera is on the bottom of the phone instead of the top of the phone pointing out, that is considered to be the quote-unquote upside down orientation. Now, when you're playing back the video on your phone, the reason you see it right side up is that it actually stores metadata about the orientation that you had the phone in or device in when you were shooting that video, and it compensates for that. So it reads that data and goes, okay, I have to flip this video over, and that's what it shows to you. And many applications recognize this data and play back just fine. But there's also some applications like Handbrake that ignore this metadata information. So if the video was shot upside down in the camera with the camera on the bottom, after you process it through something like Handbrake, it's going to come out in the orientation that you shot it in. Thus, you end up with upside down video. So the easy solution would be to always make sure, if you're shooting video on your iOS device, that you shoot with the camera oriented to the top. Barring that, if you've ended up with some video that's already shot upside down and you have some apps that aren't recognizing it, you can actually fix it pretty easily just using QuickTime that's built into your Mac by re-encoding it. So just open it up in QuickTime Player and then export it. When you export it, it's going to read in that metadata information, and then it will export it in the proper orientation. And then it won't have to rely on that metadata anymore. You can throw it through something like Handbrake and it should stay in the same corrected orientation. So Bruce, I hope that helps you out. That is a funny issue and that would have been sort of puzzling to, I think, anyone. And so hopefully your example helps a few other people out and understand why this is happening to them. And with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label. You should check out their applications. They also have PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices. You can check out all their software, get more information and details, and free trials of the Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. The Transporter by Connected Data. I already told you what that's all about, but you can get the benefits of cloud storage with the control and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS. And you can get 10% off your Transporter order by using the code MACCAST. So head over to filetransporter.com/MACCAST and take advantage of that deal. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You know, we got those new phones coming out. If you want to get some cash for your old iPhone, your old iPad, or other Apple products, you can find out what they're worth at gazelle.com, and they'll even let you lock in your iPhone offers now through October 15th. So that means you can send in your you can get your offer on your device now. You can wait to send it in until you have your new iPhone. Should give you plenty of leeway. From the 20th, you have from the 20th until October 15th to get that new device and send it into Gazelle. So you can get your offer over at gazelle.com. And Squarespace, it's the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. You can get a free trial, or better yet, 20% off this month, and this month only, by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code MACCAST9. So you can build a great website, save some cash, squarespace.com, and a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. If you have questions about the new iPhones, iPhone 5C, 5S, I'll try and help you out. If you have questions about anything else or just something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, send those emails and audio comments also. If you want to leave a voicemail, the voicemail line is 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website, maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're a social type, you're on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, all those places, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And hey, join the MacCast Google Plus community. I want to grow that community. There's a lot of great conversations going on over there. I'm trying to post there more frequently. So if you're on Google Plus, look us up, MacCast, and join in the fun there. And so I look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.